KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Inner Richmond.
Lower Haight.
Burlingame.
Mission.
Potrero Hill.
Coming up, the Golden State Warriors' last series in Oakland starts tonight. We're taking a behind-the-scenes look at the team by heading to the barbershop.
Steph walks in, says what's up to everybody, and includes the dude's like, he turns around and he looks, and he like turns around and he looks again, and his jaw just hits the floor.
A new episode of our podcast, Bounce, the Warriors' last season in Oakland. Then Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City is coming to Netflix. This time, instead of being set in the 70s, it takes place in present-day San Francisco.
It was very important to us to show the pockets where the magic still exists.
Well, there's definitely magic here on Cross Currents. Stay tuned. The Golden State Warriors host Game 3 of the NBA Finals tonight in Oakland. It's their last series in the town. So we know sports is a business. That's why the team is leaving for San Francisco, to make more money. But sports are also emotional, sentimental. In the lead up to the NBA Finals, Stephen Curry and some of his business partners decided to give back in a very sports way. His main sponsor is the athletic wear company Under Armour. So they took the star's latest signature sneaker, called the Curry 6, and made a special version, black and gold, with the name Oakland written out in big letters along the side. It's called Thank You, Oakland. Then he identified 30 people in the community who made a difference in his and others' lives, and he gave them each a pair.
Steph wanted to thank you for all that you do.
That's a pretty fancy box there.
That's an ad featuring the people that Curry honored. There's Regina Jackson, head of the East Oakland Youth Development Center, Curtis Jones, one of the security guards at Oracle Arena, and Yusuf Wright, Curry's barber. He works out of Benny Adam Grooming Parlor, just a few blocks away from the Warriors' downtown practice court. And for the latest episode of our podcast, Bounce, the Warriors' last season in Oakland, reporter Raphael Cohen walked into that barbershop, found a sense of peace, purpose, and hometown pride. And he got a bonus while putting together this next story, a beard trim and a haircut.
There are a few things that stand out at the barbershop. There's the massive mural of the Port of Oakland. There's the stunning steel sign in Arabic script. And there's a couple of autographed Steph Curry jerseys, neatly folded and subtly displayed on a shelving unit. Then, there's Yusuf Wright, a big man with a full beard and an indelibly gentle spirit.
I'm an owner and a curator and a barber at Benny Adam Grooming Parlor in downtown Oakland. I'm an Oakland native. East Oakland has been my home for the majority of my life.
Some of Yusuf's clients happen upon the shop because of its prime downtown location. Others are folks he's known since coming of age in deep East Oakland, back when he was a budding Warriors fan, even though the team was total trash.
I'm 31 right now. For the entirety of my life that I can remember, the Warriors have been in Oakland, specifically in East Oakland. It's a great time. The days of $10, $15 tickets, you know, sneaking down into the bottom of the bowl. The majority of my life, it wasn't a great product that was on court. But everybody had heart and everybody showed love, and we felt that. And you'll hear a lot of Oakland natives, you know what I'm saying, talk about Camp Hardaway and what that meant and being able to practice with Tim and being able to see him.
Tim Hardaway was a star point guard who played for the Warriors in the late 80s and early 90s. And back then, he sponsored an invite-only hoops camp for local kids, including Yusuf. I'm going to teach
y'all some skills. I mean, that was excellence. That was greatness, you know what I'm saying? To see the killer crossover in person and to have somebody who's at the peak of their game being, you know, being of and in the community. I mean, that's huge.
Class dismissed, baby.
But yeah. That Coliseum, I can hear the roars from my house. Sideshows afterwards, I feel that. You know what I mean? You're a part of that. Because Oracle was the heartbeat of this team. I know Draymond likes to say he's the heartbeat. That place is the heartbeat. That place gave life.
Yusuf isn't just another longtime Dubs fan, nor is he merely a shop owner in a rapidly changing city. He's also Steph Curry's barber. And if you followed Steph's career, you know his hairstyle's always evolving, from a close-cropped cut to the short blowout with a tight goatee to the high-top fade with a full-ish beard, and even a brief foray into mini dreads last season.
Welcome back to another episode of Guns Locked. I'm Gunther the Great, and today we're going to be looking at Steph Curry's starter dreadlocks.
Yusef might never have gotten his clippers on Steph's hair if he hadn't gone to his 10-year reunion at Bishop O'Dowd High School. That's where he reconnected with an old friend who needed a barber for a youth event at their alma mater. He thought he'd be cutting students' hair, but...
They called him like, yeah, you know, blah, blah, blah. We're doing a commercial for Under Armour. You know, there may be some Under Armour athletes there, blah, 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 but, you know. I was like, okay, that's cool. He's like, yes, are you down? I was like, yeah, that's cool. And you just kind of left it there, and I'm in my head. I'm like, man, ain't no Under Armour athletes out here.
Clearly, this was before Steph became the face of the sneaker and sports apparel brand.
I ended up calling back. I was like, yeah, so Stephen Curry's about to be at this shoot, and did you feel comfortable cutting them? And I was, yeah, for sure. So one of my partners, he let me use his truck, and I took the barber chair over there. I was like, man, if I cut this dude, I'm about to do as much as I can to show him an authentic experience. You know what I mean? His point of contact was like, yeah, Stefan, you know, he's coming in. He just needs a lineup. You know, is that cool? And I was like, yeah, it's solid. You know what I mean? Whatever you need me to do, I got it. So. Really, it just started there. I mean, I cut his hair there. I ended up, you know, doing more than a line, and from there, man, we've just been rocking, man. It's been some years now.
So how often does Steph come by for a cut these days?
Maybe 7 times this year he's come in the shop. I mean, and that's been dope. The last time I think he came in, there was this brother who I see at the mosque all the time, and he was sitting right there. And he walked, you know, Steph walks in, says what's up to everybody, and the dude's like, he turns around and he looks, and he like turns around and he looks again, and his jaw just hits the floor, just like, oh my God, that's... And he shakes his hand, and Steph keeps walking, and the dude's just looking at his hand, like in awe.
Part of their bond is that they're both religious men. Yusef is a practicing Muslim, and Steph credits his Christian faith with playing a pivotal role in his public success and private life.
I think it's just mutual respect. It's not like, oh, I'm Muslim and this is what we do, and oh, you're Christian, this is what you do. It's just about, hey, we're both men of faith, and that's how we try to guide our lives, you know what I'm saying? And all that means is that when we make mistakes, we just try to correct them, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think there's more similarities in people's faiths than differences. I think people just tend to harp in on and really get stuck on the differences, so.
I hope for more details, but Yusef stays pretty tight-lipped.
You know, barber chairs are like Vegas, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, typically what happens there, you know what I'm saying? Stays there, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So, like I said, I'm not going to dive too deep,
sure.
What I will say is we both understand and realize that it's faith that guides us in what we do and how we lead our families, mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So, he has, you know, daughters and a family and a wife, and I have a daughter and a wife, and you know what I'm saying? We're just trying to both lead our family in the right way.
Mm-hmm. While Yusef keeps his conversations with Steph confidential, he does offer some insight into the current state of the star's hair.
It's playoff time, man, so we're going to keep the length and we're going to get that beard growing, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's winning time, man. It's winning time.
Yusef's confident in the Warriors' chances for a three-peat, but like many longtime Oaklanders, he's decidedly less upbeat about the team's move across the bay.
I don't know any sports team who's been to the upper echelons, like, of competition as long as we have in these last 5-6 years, and then has had that team move. Could you imagine if the Bulls were on a road to three-peat in the next season, they moved from Chicago? Like, even if they were still, you know what I'm saying? Even if they were still somewhere in that great state, if they moved from Chicago, you'd feel some type of way. That's nothing towards the players, you know what I'm saying? It's the business of the sport. But at some point it's like, yo, you feel disrespected almost. I mean, that one hurts. That, you know, we're on the quest for three and for three in a row. And even if we get it, we, you know what I'm saying, and God willing we get it, you know that they're not gonna be back. I think everybody wants to see something that they created or something that they've nourished grow into something beautiful and successful, you know what I mean? And you want to see how long you can keep that, you know what I mean? It's a different part of the chess game. And this isn't an indictment or an accusation of everybody who lives in the city. My dad's from the city, you know what I mean? But, you know, the city is not the same as it used to be either. You know what I mean? What they say is the most densely populated amount of billionaires in the country. I mean, irony is like, doesn't even encompass all of the things, but that our team is finally good and now they go to San Francisco. I mean, that's a heck of a blow, you know what I mean? But it'll definitely have an impact on the town that it's leaving. But you know, it's been a hell of a ride, and I'm happy that we're doing what we're doing now. So I've seen two parades go by, and that's not even 100 steps past my business, you know what I mean? It's a beautiful thing, and I'm hoping that I get confetti on my floors again from a parade at the end of the year, you know what I mean? So,
as for what keeps Steph coming back to Youssef's barbershop,
there's trust there. And I think, you know, I think it's beyond trust with just hair, you know what I'm saying? My barber instructor told me, like, if a man exposes his throat to you with a razor, you can never disrespect that trust. You know what I'm saying? And this is something that I love, and I think he understands and appreciates that, like, yo, this is a craft of mine, and he has a craft of his own, and we both are on a quest to master our crafts, you know?
It's the barbershop, you know the rules. No fighting, no cussing, no blooding. Just sit yourself down and act like you got some sense.
That's reporter Rafael Cohen with an assist from Marco Seiler Gonzalez. And that was an excerpt from our podcast, Bounce, the Warriors' last season in Oakland. And you can find it on your favorite podcast player. And while you're there, make sure you're subscribed to the Cross Currents podcast, too. Catch up on Bounce while the Warriors play their final games in Oakland starting tonight.
Now if your fade is as tight as we is on the mic, just got your whip clean and your kicks on tight. About to pull the flyest chick you ever pulled in your life. Then you doing what we doing and you doing it right. Now if your fade is as tight as we is on the mic, just got your whip clean and your kicks on tight. About to pull the flyest chick you ever pulled in your life. And you doing what we doing and you doing it right.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Netflix is launching a new version of Tales of the City this weekend, and it begins with a scene where a documentary filmmaker sits down with the show's matriarch, Anna Madrigal.
You ready to start?
Yes, I suppose we better hurry if you don't want me to croak on screen.
So, what are your thoughts on how San Francisco's changed?
Not much, actually.
Really?
We're still people, aren't we? I mean, flawed, narcissistic, and doing our best.
That live and let live, glass half full ethos has always been the MO for Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City. It helps that he began writing them in the mid-70s. What began as a serial fiction column in the San Francisco Chronicle has so far spawned 9 novels and 3 TV miniseries. KALW's David Boyer met up with the creators of the new show to see how it jives with the beloved TV and book series and with today's San Francisco.
When I sat down with Armistead Maupin, I posed the same question that the new Tales of the City begins with, about how San Francisco has changed.
I would probably have to answer the way that Anna does, where she says, well, we're still people, aren't we? And we are, and some lovely people are here. In fact, lovely people within the tech industry that aspire to living at 28 Barbary Lane. And they can for a few million dollars. To that degree, the bohemian dream is sort of not around anymore.
The original miniseries made a star of Laura Linney. She played Marianne Singleton, a young, sheltered Midwesterner whose mind is expanded by the people she meets at the fictional 28 Barbary Lane. While separated by a couple of decades, my story is not that different than Marianne's and so many people who have migrated to San Francisco to become freer, more honest versions of themselves. I arrived in 1993, fresh out of a fairly conservative college back east. Officially, I moved to the Bay Area because I had a few friends here. But really, I came to come out. Somehow, I hadn't heard of Armistead Maupin's books. But that first winter, the media was abuzz about a PBS miniseries that was going to feature the first man-on-man kiss on American television. I tuned in for the smooch. But what really captivated me was the dreamy, disco-infused San Francisco of the 1970s. This Tales of the City world, created by Armistead, became a North Star for my new queer bohemian life. Fast forward 25 years. I'm totally out, working in public radio, living a fairly unconventional life, and Tales of the City is returning to the small screen as a Netflix limited series. Except this time, instead of being a nostalgia trip, it's set in the San Francisco of now, which is as beautiful as the city I fell in love with all those years ago. But it feels a lot less bohemian and sparkly these days, with a homelessness crisis, never-ending traffic, and staggering inequalities. Alan Poole has produced all of the TV Tales adaptations beginning in 1993. This time around, he's also directing several episodes. More than anyone working on this project, it was his job to bridge the differences between the world of the original and this new Tales. And he wasn't ready to give up on the bohemian dream.
The show is not a political show. So I don't believe there's some mandate that we have to deal with every pressing issue, although we're aware of them and want to address them. But it was very important to show how San Francisco has changed. It was also equally important to us to show the pockets where the magic still exists.
I'm curious, given San Francisco right now and the homelessness issue, how did you approach that?
Well, I think that by having our characters once, not to give any spoilers, but once they have to look for new places to live, finding they can't afford anything was one of the ways of dealing with the current situation of San Francisco.
They also hired a 30-something lesbian to lead the day-to-day production of the show and to guide it creatively.
Hi, I'm Lauren Morelli. I'm the showrunner of Tales of the City.
The tone of Tales is 2 feet off the ground. It's a little magical. It's a little shinier than the real world. And it's also a safe place. And it felt very important to represent San Francisco, however, to represent it within the tone of Tales. So we really tried to walk that line of let's talk about the problems, let's talk about how unlivable it is, let's talk about Michael not being able to afford an apartment, while still making it a cozy place that you want to really snuggle into. It's not a documentary.
When Lauren came in to be the showrunner, and we put together an entirely queer team of writers, and we started from, we have to preserve Armistead's DNA in the characters and in the tone and in the dialogue and in everything about the story. Of course, nothing was going to happen without Armistead's approval and consent.
I can't imagine, frankly, handing over my life's work to somebody else as openly as he did. I mean, he just really, really trusted us.
I really felt like I might have made this up myself. And that's great, because that makes me look much hipper than I am. Lauren really dug into the characters and knew what they would do, even if it was a brand new situation.
The new situation is matriarch Anna Madrigal's 90th birthday. All of her adopted children slash tenants from the original return to celebrate her, including Marianne, who's since moved to Connecticut, and her BFF Michael Mouse, who still lives at 28 Barbary Lane.
I mean, there's things you don't have choices about, like bring back the original characters. Why do this if you're not going to bring back these amazing characters? And then it felt like, but we also need to update it. Like, this show needs to look like how the world looks.
Which meant kind of expanding the younger generation, creating more new characters, dealing on a larger scale with issues of gender fluidity, and addressing the kind of generation gap that exists between Mouse's generation and today's generation.
Because there's also a conversation happening between the original Tales and this Tales, and the original Tales was largely white and largely male.
The new generation includes artists and drag queens, techies and trans men. And even as the San Francisco that I live in gets less and less diverse, the alternative universe of the new Tales of the City is increasingly Asian, Latino, African American, and it's totally and unapologetically queer. Marianne comes face to tits with this new vision of Bohemia one night at a burlesque show.
All right, Marianne. I don't understand. How exactly is that feminist? My generation was trying to liberate women from objectification, not encourage it.
So you're like old school.
Well, I'm not a suffragette, but yes.
Well, first of all, honey, this is a co-op, so everyone who works here is an owner.
Body Politic, which is a bar depicted on the show, is very much a throwback to a San Francisco that we all wish still existed, right?
But see, I don't feel objectified. I own my body, and I'm making a choice.
Exactly. See, everything we do here is about empowerment.
So you're telling me the most feminist thing I could do right now is go up on that stage and take my clothes off?
In a queer feminist burlesque co-op? Fuck yeah, it is.
What's the second most feminist thing I could do?
A similar dynamic is played out in the May-December relationship between Michael Mouse from the original and his biracial boyfriend, Ben, who's more than 20 years younger and works in tech. The tension between the past and present, older and younger, whiteness and color, comes to a head midway through the series.
Oh, you made it.
Ben finds himself at a dinner party with the A-gays, as we call them, and Ben's the only person of color there, and he's certainly the only person who's maybe, let's say, under 40. And there's an argument over whether someone is allowed to use the word tranny, and the argument kind of spirals out from there.
I don't think that we use that word.
Sorry?
Tranny. It's offensive, and...
Does anyone want more wine?
Yes.
Please.
I just don't really appreciate that we have to be police.
At a f***ing gay dinner party.
Is this a Bordeaux?
It's a brilliant scene. You can see everybody's point.
You know, when you talk about why now in terms of bringing back Tales, I feel like we have had to present ourselves as a queer community as exactly one thing, and we are so many things.
Why is your generation obsessed with labels?
Because what you call someone is important. It's about dignity. It's about visibility.
Okay.
I think we owe that to people, especially when you're coming from a place of privilege.
So you look at me, and you see what? A rich white man? Is that my privilege?
Yeah. Yes.
And I think because we haven't been able to have those conversations, there's a lot of resentment.
Guys, I don't think...
Let me tell you something. When I was 28, I wasn't going to f***ing dinner parties. I was going to funerals. Three or four a week. All of us were.
I understand that, I do.
Oh, you do? Really? Why? Because you saw Angels in America? F*** that. You have no idea. This world that you get to live in, with your safe spaces and your intersectionalities.
And gay marriage.
F***ing without condoms.
All of it. This entitlement you now have to dignity and visibility as a gay person. Do you know who built that world? Do you know the cost of that progress? No, of course not.
We were shooting that scene, and there wasn't a dry eye on the set.
I mean, that scene is very important to me, but the fight isn't about language. For older gay men who lived through the epidemic, it just rankles that the younger generation doesn't really have a sense of the history that got them where they were and doesn't want to understand, and that's what the scene's about.
That history has been and continues to be told through Tales of the City.
I've been living with these characters for 40 years.
And Armistead's not done with them yet. In fact, he's already planning the next book.
My next one is dealing with one of the characters that I'm told that I have neglected.
And the city that we both love, well, it's no longer the dreamy Bohemia that Armistead wrote about, or the one I moved to 25 years ago, or even the one that the new series conjures. But for me, it's still better than the alternatives. As our interview comes to a close, I begin to imagine a future for Armistead and me. Maybe we could grab coffee at Cafe Flore in the Castro. Maybe he could give me a tour of McCondry Lane in Russian Hill, his inspiration for Barbary Lane.
You're in town now, in general. If there's a follow-up, is that possible?
You don't know where I'm going, do you?
I don't. Where are you going?
My husband and I are moving to England in 2 days. I want a new adventure, and I don't want my last adventure to be San Francisco. I love it with all my heart and with all my work, but I want to try something new.
I have come to terms with many of the changes around the Bay, but this one is harder to swallow. This city, without Armistead, it just doesn't feel right. In San Francisco, I'm David Boyer for CrossKinds.
The new Tales of the City is available beginning this Friday on Netflix. This music is by New Spell from San Francisco. They're performing at Amnesia this Friday. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Jonathan Davis, Magnolia McKay, Kevin McLean, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega-Welch, True Gwynn, Eli Wortschefter, and Alice Wolfley. Our engineers are Tarek Foda, Gabe Graben, and Kristen McCandless. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.